Ken has admonished me to weave my life into this talk and make it personal sharing. And that might just come automatically, but I haven't thought formally about how to do that. Still in all, I have learned that you write a book, unless you know Oprah, you don't just sit back and let the orders come in. you become a shameless huckster. And I want to tell you, I do not want to carry that load of books home. And so I only make a nickel on each one, so please buy one. And I'll even sign, I'll say nice things in the flyleaf if you do that.
Is there a last-minute discount?
This is the last-minute discount. if you go to the publisher's website, they'll say this is $40 list price. And I say, this is ridiculous. There's not a Christian on the planet that will spend over $20 for a book. we're light readers. But they say, well, you know, the online order is only $32. And I say, far too much. And they say, okay, tell you what. You buy them at office discount, sell them for whatever you want. And so I make a nickel on each one of these. Now, this talk is kind of where is technology taking us as the conference theme, and it's promising us some good things, and it's bringing us some risks that we want to talk about. And I started with this picture you can get. Now, this picture from the Illustrated Pilgrim's Progress shows the shepherds looking at the future, but it's rather imprecise. So I imported a picture of the New Jerusalem coming down from the heavens. And the New Jerusalem is a crystal city that's been fabricated by the best engineering techniques. So now they're playing with something more concrete and religious. My argument is that in this culture, technology is a religious practice. And I don't mean just by technologists, I mean by the users, by our culture. And I am trying to make the case that that this religious approach to technology must be unmasked because it's unrecognized by the church. And it amounts to a competing worldview that in many respects competes with the biblical one. So, I'll give you a quiz. There's only one right answer. If you had one word to characterize U.S. culture, what word would you pick? Some of you are going to say, well, post-Christian, because you've been taught that. And others will say, well, it's really post-modern. And those would be the wrong answers. But the right answer is, it's technological. I submit you'd be hard-pressed to come up with a single word that better capturizes? Our culture. Thank you very much. Who was that? So our culture is technological at its core, and it's one of the things that best distinguishes us from other cultures. So before we plow into why I say that, let me give you some recent headlines. And just out of the last month, I clipped these from newspapers, or maybe a couple of months. These are literal quotes from the headlines of local and area newspapers that I subscribe to. Smart prosthetics. Intelligent design. Well, we Christians have an understanding of what that means, but this headline is the Japanese culture is aging. They no longer have young people to hire to be their servants, and so they're hiring robots not only to do household chores, but also to be companions. Or developing research or robots. Intelligent safety for our automobiles. Soon our automobiles will be accident-free because we cannot wreck them, because they will intercept our mistakes and reprogram what we have in mind. Virtual playground. How many of you have visited Webkinz? Well, your children might be. And it's educational and entertaining, but also, it turns out, you can also buy stuff. Surprise, surprise. The toys and the companions that they offer. There's also something called GodTube. Anybody visit GodTube? It's an online program with all kinds of spiritual resources in the Christian faith. Online sermons and lookups and research and references and so on. Conformity, surveillance, I have a video if we get time to look at that, but surveillance, we are more and more being watched, not just at intersections where we run red lights, but all over the place. Even our cell phones are being listened to now, or they might be, especially if you have a GPS tracker in them. How many of you have GPS in your cell phones? What? Just one. Okay. Technology is not just something to worry about, but the church is, as it should, using technology to expand its reach, not just to send its missionaries, but to send the message by internet and to assist ones who do. And 3D online worlds, the virtual world, I'll get to what my son does for a living in a bit, but in fact, terrorists use the new virtual world realm of the internet against us? So let's get into a little bit more what I'm talking about when I say the technology, and I'm using the term broadly, but I want to talk about secular definitions of the term. It is simply the process, the engineering definition is the process of constructing artifacts from raw materials. But it's also the skills of knowledge for making and doing things. So but that's what a social scientist might say. However, if you were trying to look for a biblical definition, you'd come up with a different answer. It's a capability that God gave human beings, and for a purpose. The purposes are to fulfill his commands to go and what? Well, not just multiply, but exercise dominion. And we'll come back to what this might mean. So it's biblical as well. Although the term isn't used explicitly, it's definitely implicit. So let's jump into my topic by looking at this picture from the New Yorker of about 10 months ago. The original Stone Age man, barely up from the ape, eventually learning how to make wheels to move his logs, and now he's actually developed tools in the third stage, and eventually arrives at the Egyptian culture, which is pretty advanced for its age, including, but a lot of human power. And in the next stage, we have animal power, and man has learned to harness the power of animals to do the things he wants. And the next thing we know is he's starting to use natural energy, if you will, in this case, wind energy, to further advance his causes. And lo and behold, fossil energy to burn it, or even wood to make steam. And steam can do tremendous things that neither wind nor animal energy could. And that leads eventually to transportation based upon steam and the electronic age, which leads to electronic and electrical machines and invents the escalator, which breaks and falls apart. And the question is there a precipice that we're going over? Well, this is a kind of an illustration from the New Yorker offered me to show what the talk is about. So, technology has purpose. I already mentioned a biblical one, but if you went to an academic institution and began studying technology and culture, you'd say that technology is first and foremost to relieve human suffering and to provide comfort and well-being to all of us, and maybe to relieve our toil and our immobility and our boredom. All these things engineers tell themselves, and engineering educators tell their students, you're learning to do all these grand things. It's for the good of the planet and the good of the people who live on it. To provide us safety and security, to increase our efficiency and increase our productivity, these are all good things. I remember being taught them as an engineering student, and I was proud. Also, I get freedom, power, and control. Now, the question, now I begin to ask myself, well, but wait, now, how much control is good? How much freedom should I have? And I wonder if maybe there isn't some autonomy creeping in here that maybe is good and maybe is not so good. Medical science is certainly increasing our longevity, but so is public health, so has public health. But where does that point to? Can we attain immortality? Immorality, yeah, but immortality is being talked about in the biosciences field. And technology, this is kind of the theme of the conference, extending our horizons as creatures, doing things we could never have dreamed of doing in the past. And the question then is, but does this new horizon extend to transcendence, where we become, we can in fact transcend the gap between ourselves and whatever God might be? So we were told right off the bat in Scripture to be fruitful and increase in number. And we succeeded. This chart, if you can imagine what it looks like, is a chart showing jumps in population from tens of thousands of years ago. And the idea is that technology has enabled great leaps in the carrying capacity of the planet. The first leap was tool making, and the second leap was agriculture, and the third leap was the Industrial Revolution, which can be further broken down into others. But the next is, well, okay, after the Industrial Revolution, is there another leap in carrying capacity of the planet that's coming? And there would be an optimistic view that would say, yeah, there's another leap. We're going to be able to carry 12 to 15 to 20 billion people sustainably. There were those who would say, no, we won't. Actually, we're coming to a limit, and population is going to crash as we run out of resources. So the question is, are we on a stable trajectory? Are we about to reach a new leap up, or are we about to hit a precipice and crash down? And the argument, which is the conclusion here, is basically, if you're optimistic about technology, you're going to say, well, you know, we're on an upward slope and there really are no limits. If you are a pessimist, you might say we're at the threshold of a real problem. And the issue is moving on to worldviews and getting to think about that. Now, this is a photo of our son undergoing brain surgery. 5 years ago, he was having epileptic seizures that were running his life, taking over and ruining his life. And what is happening here is that a high-resolution X-ray device is being used to steer a catheter and apply anesthesia to selected parts of his brain. In fact, he was awakened during surgery to respond so they could know where to do the cutting, because he was having some what they called hemorrhaging, but it was just small leaks of a blood vessel. At any rate, they found the source, they excised it, removed the damaged tissue, and sewed him back up, and he's been 5 years free of seizures. He's resumed a life. So I'm pretty excited. We are certainly about medical science. And half of us in this room would not be here today if it were not for the advances in medicine and public health that have been enabled by technology. So lest you came worried that I was going to scorch technology and say it's only done for sinister purposes, in fact, technology has done and continues to do great things for mankind. So we're talking about progress. It's kind of the unwritten theme of the conference, and certainly of my talk and Edwin's. So let's decide what we mean by that. Technological process means novelty, increased power, and these go back to some of the definitions of the term. Human comfort enhances enhancements to our senses, things we couldn't do before. If you're a sociologist, you would say progress is something that increases citizenship and makes a better society, more livable. If you were biblical, however, progress is glorifying God, increasing in wisdom, and healing his creation from the damage that's been in it since the fall. Very different definitions of progress. We were told to go and make disciples. This is my argument that I'm trying to create in this book for the church and getting ASA, persuade ASA to take up as a theme. If we are, we who are calling ourselves Christians are going to witness to a technological culture, and the saints we call believers are equipped to do that job, we have to know what we're facing. If the culture is technological, and to use Jesus' terminology in one of his parables, to live as salt and light, in the Old Testament book of 1 Chronicles, we find a case where the men of Issachar, one of the tribes of Israel, are said to have understood the times and know what Israel should do. I'm saying that ASA has a role in understanding technological culture and telling the church how to respond. In fact, Paul the Apostle tells us in Romans to not conform any longer to the patterns of this world, but be transformed in some way. And how? Well, through the mind, renewing the mind. Scary thought. The basis of progress. What is progress? Well, all right, it goes in a progressive sense. In innovation, technological innovation, so produces new technologies which increase our productivity, as I said in an earlier chart, which brings economic growth, which then results in progress. This is the classic understanding of how the process works in our technological culture. To a certain extent, the whole Industrial Revolution had Christian roots because it was an attempt to a quest to comprehend nature, and it was driven by the desire to know the God who created nature. Technology was always slightly different alongside that, but slightly different because technology was always, since the Revolution at least, viewed as a tool to exercise dominion and to carry out God's command to do that and spread the faith. So technologies provide us lots of good things and lots of bad things, but Philip Yancey, who lives near Ken in Indian Hills, has argued that we spend too much time worrying about the negatives. We should, in fact, think about the good things that are happening. And so he went and made a list and published his list to persuade us that we're overly pessimistic. Global literacy hasn't, this is over a 20-year period preceding the date of his paper, global literacy has improved, malnutrition has gone down, clean water access has risen, population peak is no longer the horrendous 20 billion, now it's stabilized perhaps at 9 billion. Infant mortality worldwide has gone down. Smallpox, polio, and leprosy have been nearly eradicated. Teen birth rate is down, and the abortion rate is down. So he's saying, stop being so pessimistic, Christians. And indeed, lots of good things from technology. Abundance, choice, speed, power, efficiency, productivity, economy, ease, etc. Now, but if you look at these, abundance first is a supply of material necessities, which then eventually becomes abundance as we get real good at that. But where does it go? Where do you say enough is enough? Where is enough too much? Where does it become too much? Choice is good. We always say more choices makes life better. But first it's variety, then it becomes choice, and then proliferation. Eventually a distraction, confusion in the aisle of the shop, of the supermarket, and anxiety. There's a choice anxiety stress. Speed is good, but it becomes a rush in itself because our speeds of things we're doing are now faster than our time to react, to deal with the speeds that we're dealing with. Now, the human reaction times are actually speeding up, at least our children's speeds are, as they do video gaming. Ours, we may be in trouble. Power was originally a force multiplier, but of course power, and my nuclear weapons career was part of that, the applications can become very destructive. Efficiency and productivity are good because the GDP rises when we get more productive. But it becomes the pursuit of wealth as an end in itself. When does productivity become too much? Economy, ease, and functionality is a good quest, but it leads to complexity and opacity and something called feature creep, which is a sort of a technological kudzu. That is, the gadget near you becomes more and more complex with features you don't want, but you have to get because it's there. And eventually, technology itself becomes a burden. And I mean that it takes so much time to... Now, Terry, forgive me, because I know you do this for a living. But time demands just to acquire, learn, operate, maintain, program, and eventually what do I do with it? And Ellen Goodman, the humorous columnist in the Boston Globe, said that the amount of time she spent acquiring and programming her technological gadgets over the last 10 years, she could have learned Mandarin. But the difference is that the devices are now obsolete, and so is the programming that she did to learn them. Mandarin, however, could have still been useful. Now, measuring progress, and this is where I'm headed eventually, is maybe prescribed quantitatively as more, and you can read the list of more. As we make progress, is this a sufficient way to describe progress? More stuff? Or what about faster things? Is that a good measure for progress? Well, heck, if we can do faster digital operations, we can do more computing and computers can become better servants. Or how about bigger? Homes, gross domestic product, cruise ships, integrated circuits. I mean, bigger is better. It's progress. We sort of assume that. Or maybe even smaller. Because our integrated circuits get smaller and our nanoparticles get smaller. But along with it, our storage devices get smaller. The number of gigabytes on our flash drives are more and more. And good grief, where's the limit? Where's the limit? The end. So what I'm asking is it really right to consider these things quantitatively, progress? It's fun to think about progress on the left column. The green revolution that's going to feed the hungry in the world using genetic modified organisms or agriculture. Inexhaustible sources of energy or renewable sources. Private space travel is already happening. Buy your ticket. Repeatable experience. By that I mean the media, for example, or a recording. Whereas a few centuries ago, if you wanted to experience something, you had to go and be there. But now you can hear it and see it anytime you want, again and again and again. Transhuman species, maybe smart cars and so on. There's a lot of interesting and fun ideas on the left that are in the news. And yet, on the right, some of these are worrisome. The fear-mongers say that it's not GMO foods, it's Franken-foods, because maybe they will turn us into monsters if we eat them. We don't know yet, they are saying. Eugenics, the control of the lifespan by decision processes, is a concern. The depletion of resources to maintain our lifestyles, on and down the list, identity theft, and so on. There's some concerns that creep in when you look at it this way. So I'm saying that progress can't be defined by more, better, faster, bigger, or even smaller. It has to be defined in terms of its impact, in terms of its qualitative nature. So here are some measures or some ways to talk about qualitative impacts, the human footprint on the planet. Happiness, not really measured. Hunger, safety and security, some of the social science approaches to progress, or, if you want, spiritual and scriptural ones. Communication, justice, mobility, sustainability, satisfaction. I'm saying these are the things that aren't measured as more or bigger or faster, but they are very much a measure of progress and need to be considered. So in engineering parlance, these are vectors. They have direction rather than just more of same. So to get this point across, I need to talk about surprises. Technology has consequences that were intended, and technology has consequences that were not intended. It's always the case. It's probably not a rule that's just limited to technology, but I'm talking about technology. And some of these are the intent, some of these are surprises, some of these are show up way down the line. So we design something, we technologists, and we say, this is what I intend for it to do, and it does, and I'm happy. But there's also, better than that, sometimes we get happy surprises, which we call serendipity. In a case of point, it would be Teflon, or Scotch tape, or penicillin, or some of these other happy surprises that are cited as the reward for investing in technology and research. But also, we have things, because engineers are not perfect, they design things that fail down the road due to fatigue or corrosion or failure to anticipate the environment it'll be steeped in. And there are consequences that just were not thought of. And a case in point in the internet would, or using software, would be spam and spyware and other things that are called malware. When we first began, when Bill Gates first began writing software in the 1970s in a high-rise in Albuquerque, when Ken and I were there, he was going to do DOS. I think he was working on DOS or something. The idea of malware and spyware was certainly not part of the thinking about the future of software. Nasty surprises, such as DDT, persistent chlorinated hydrocarbons in the biosphere. Who would have thought about the impacts of some of those? Emergent outcomes are things that happen only after the technology has become part of the culture, and it's almost irreversible. And then I'm going to introduce the idea of social and spiritual impacts. And mostly we learn these things by trial and error. We go do them, eager for the good outcomes, and then we learn that, well, maybe we've gone too far too fast, and we say, well, wait, let's see if we can correct our errors. It's a trial and error process. It's not a managed one. So this raises the ethical question that I want to stick out here for your consideration. That is that the question is, should we try to slow down the rate at which technology is adopted in the culture in order to provide time to think about these consequences? Should we? Well, there will be an economic cost for doing that, or there could be. So we're now talking about ethics against economics. Always the hard way to go about it. I mean, a hard question to struggle with. So I'm saying that progress is vector in nature. Here's an unanticipated consequence. Or maybe it's an impending accident. I'm saying that really we need to think about impact of technology in four dimensions. The environmental one dominates the literature and the newspapers and the media. Much talk about and much evidence about, well, global warming is the hottest one. Social and cultural, I'm beginning to talk about those. Aesthetic, the paving over and the building upon scenic vistas, or even obscuring them with smog. And I'm saying there is a spiritual set of impacts which are not much talked about, and that's what I am going to focus on. But these are all excusable. I mean, environmental protection costs jobs. We can't spend time on that. Or aesthetic damage is just the price of progress. Just live with it. Or the social and cultural problems, we can solve those with technology. There are technical solutions to these problems. Or the market. Let the market fix these problems. Quit. Don't meddle with it. So I'm saying that impacts of technology are four-dimensional. Maybe you could put on five. And I can't draw four dimensions on a plain paper, but imagine this is four-dimensional. The spiritual, the environmental, the social, and the aesthetic. And I'm hoping that in the breakout sessions, you can come back to this and talk about, well, how are I going to measure spiritual progress from technology? How am I going to measure social progress? And I want this to be a conversation, and I want you to contribute to knowledge in this area. I said environmental impacts are familiar. We are fouling the nest that we came from. This is Bizarro's view. I'm not teaching this. I'm just saying enjoy it. So back to just the price of progress. I took this snapshot of a development near our home, and I'm saying that This is a picture, a snapshot of the problem that we are facing environmentally. This is increasing our dependence upon what? Automobiles, foreign oil, and the problems that come with it. Here is a queue, a study in queuing, the lineup at a local Starbucks. Here is a study of idol worship. This is the local auto detailing center on a Sunday morning when I was on my way home from Sunday school. These people were at the shrine of the Sunday morning automobile. The price of progress is a failed transportation system. I'm sorry, dear. I can't answer the question until later. This is my wife asking me that. Smog. This is an aesthetic problem, the price of progress. Global warming is much in the news. The Arctic ice pack has shrunk. The Arctic ice has been shrinking, but I've read that the Antarctic is now more worrisome than what's happening in the Arctic. That in West Antarctica, ice loss has accelerated 60% in the last decade. And if it continues at this rate, it will raise sea levels by several meters at the end of this century. So there's the Arctic photo. Arable land. Now, our host, Terry and Barbara, picked us up at the airport yesterday and drove us to their house in Loveland over the back roads because he won't pay for the tolls. Is that? Yeah. And I saw the tidal wave of houses sweeping over the hills and down towards the airport. And I live in California, and I know we started this whole mess. We know what it's like. But I'm telling you that arable land is not an infinite resource, and we are gobbling it up at a rate that is of great concern. And the conversion of ag land to low-density housing typifies the dispersion of society, which locks us into automobiles. And now you can say, well, that wasn't very productive land anyway. You don't get much rain here, and the winters are long, and the summers are short. But happening nationwide, it is a significant issue that I would like to put on the list of things to talk about. So I'm saying that technology has social and spiritual impacts. I mentioned the dispersion of society and damage to community. Well, I think that garage door openers are a trivial case in point, where we no longer talk to our neighbors while we're opening the garage door. We open it up from a distance as we come around the corner, we drive and we close it behind us, and that's that. You never even see your neighbor, let alone talk to them. But we're also talking about issues like our lives are ordered by technology, and eventually we're talking about preoccupation with technological things. Opacity, I will illustrate in a minute, but it means we understand less and less about the things that we have to use and manage, and we can't fix them anymore, and we don't even know why they work. And we're losing our contact with nature because we think groceries come from Safeway. And the idea that they come from a farm and our understanding of the farm is in a distant memory. Dissipation, I'm saying that the by that I mean if you want boredom or lifestyle diseases, and I'll illustrate a couple of these. Neil Postman wrote a book called Amusing Ourselves to Death. Stress, we know about that, related to the pace of life. Now, distraction means because we're so focused on technology, the good may become the enemy of the best. And the best, in our case, is focusing on the Creator. We're too busy. And I'll show you what I mean more about it. And I talked about idolatry in a joking sort of way. And the transhumanists are redefining what it means to be human, the biotechnologists of today. Now, here's a quick example of unanticipated impact of technology. When the birth control pill was introduced in 1960, the idea was that unwed births would surely come down, or births overall would come down. But what happened is they grew. Now, why is that? Well, there are arguments pro and con about why did unmarried births rise after the advent of the birth control pill. And the popular notion is that because our whole a view of sexuality changed in the culture. That technological advance changed our view, our cultural view of sexuality. Here's a picture of opacity. Now, this might be the way your computer works. It's the way an Apple works, I know that. But it might also be under the hood of your car. For all we know in today's modern technology, this is what's going on under the hood of the car. It's just simply not knowable to all but technological experts. Lifestyle diseases, we know about those, and they're related to the way we live in our vehicles and the way we spend our free time at home. And stress, the pace of life, I've talked about that. Everything is getting faster. And how do you deal with the stress? Well, there are also chemical solutions to stress. We create these problems, then we use technology to try to solve them. And there's another picture from Bizarro about chemical solutions to stress. I don't know if you can read this. I am a Fexer, and this is my friends Celexa and Paxil and Lexapro of the planet Prozac. You are the last Earthling we have to conquer. Multitasking. Many pictures of that. And the good idea is that we are connecting people. The concern is we're also distracting. These are distracting things. Or maybe they're even intrusive. How many of you have not sat next to an intrusive cell phone user in a restaurant or elsewhere? And maybe it's worse than that. Maybe no longer do we get together face-to-face to talk. Now all our relationships are virtual. Preoccupation is another issue, another picture of the advent of man. The same theme you're seeing us over and over in different ways. Now, eventually, with a cell phone, we're about to walk off the cliff. Preoccupation is with the internet. If this seems close to home, you're squirming, don't worry about it, this is somebody else. What happens? Personality fragmentation. Personal relationships, are they being damaged because cyber relationships are replacing personal ones? Is inauthentic behavior that's learned virtually replacing real interactions? Are children perhaps less satisfied with reality because it can be more exciting in the virtual space, cyberspace? Pornographic addiction, you know that pornography actually paid for the development of the internet. That's where the real money came from at the beginning. Cybercrime is a vulnerability that we never had before the internet, but it's not bad necessarily. Distraction. What about text messaging and the vow of silence? Is it consistent or is it not? Now, I wonder about this. When human race was in its new state and struggled just to survive from the wild beasts and to try to get enough food to live, there was no time to think about God because they were too busy trying to survive. And I'm saying that today we're too busy with our technology to think about God. We're distracted. So was there a time that we passed and we missed it? And was there was more time to focus on God? Was it sometime in our childhood or our parents' generation? I just wonder. Because it wasn't then, way back, and it isn't now. It must have been in between, if there was a time. Profound. This is Michelangelo's picture of God reaching out to Adam and inviting him to fellowship. The classic picture is in the Sistine Chapel, I think. So Adam now is saying, just a minute, God, I'm too busy. I got a phone call, and notice Adam, what kind of computer Adam is. Security. We use technology to make us feel safe. Or are we trusting it instead of God? That's the question. We're using technology to free us from boredom. We have robot games that are trained. We win by destroying others' robots. So this technology is invested in making robots that can seek and destroy the other robots and compete. Computer games. You know, most of them are violent and misogynist. Women are shown as property and dealt with. So are we in fact entertaining ourselves? Are we educating ourselves? Or are we training ourselves in violence? What's really going on here? Idolatry. Are we defining who we are by the things we acquire and own? The question is, what purposes are being served by the devices that I show here? Clearly not transportation, clearly not communication, clearly not education. There are some other things going on here. Homo technicus, we don't have time to get into biotech, but it's an incredibly explosive field. The progress with the human genome and understanding and replacing body organs and growing new ones. And I showed an example of our son as a beneficiary. But did you read about the pigs in Korea that glow in the dark? They have bred pigs that are fluorescent. And the purpose is to use them as markers and trackers for studies in biology, because this is a reproducible feature. It's these pigs' children also glow in the dark. So what happens when you start crossing species boundaries? Does it get away from you? Could it? So we need to be careful here, because strange things can happen. Imagine if this got out of the laboratory.
Somebody sent you that on an email.
Who is that lady? And just 2 months ago, or less than a month ago, South Koreans announced, or where was this? Was it South Korea? No, that was the wrong way. It was in the U.S. that mature human embryos had been created from adult skin cells, perhaps an ethical advance. And the embryos could have been grown to maturity. So therefore, what were they? Who were their parents? The problem we have with cloning is that cloned embryos tend to develop abnormally. And the question for spiritualists is, does the clone have a soul like his brother? And who are the parents? And when we are told to reproduce after our kind and fill the earth, is cloning one of the techniques that's admissible under the Genesis command? So let's talk now about how technology gets into the society. And if you are a technophile over on the right, you are a technological optimist and an early adopter, you will rush out and buy the first thing off the shelf as soon as it's released. In fact, you will line up at the store to get it and have the first one. You can go and take it home and show your friends. And if you lag a little bit, you become part of the early majority. These people are considered pioneers because they find the first generation with the bugs in it, and those bugs are reported to the manufacturer and taken out, and then the early majority can buy them with less risk. If you wait and wait and wait, you become a late adopter and eventually a laggard or a technophobe. And you ask yourself, well, where are the Amish on this list? And where am I? And where are you? Woven into this is worldview issues. Where do you stand, and where does the Bible tell you to stand, or us to stand in this matter? And what this leads to is something called technology assessment. And that is the question I raised at the outset. Should we slow the rate of introduction of new technologies in order to deal with these issues before they come up, think about what to do about them? And this would give, if we just could slow it down, we could have more time to think about that, or maybe speed up our way of adapting to it. And who should take part in this if we do it? Well, technology developers, and I'm saying social scientists and policymakers, because we do, in fact, have technology assessment going on. I mean, that's why we have regulatory bodies, the Nuclear Regulatory Agency and the Environmental Protection Agency and so forth. And the rest of society, the people who are going to be affected by it, which means it'll be a dialogue and therefore an awkward, slow, contentious democratic process. But okay. How do we measure? Well, I'll get to this very quickly, but the idea is, look, here's a chart of environmental events, and here's a logarithmic scale on the horizontal about the spatial extent of these events. On the vertical scale is the horizontal logarithmic scale of how long it takes to recover on the naturally occurring rates, causes. Global warming is the worst of the worst. It covers the entire Earth, and its recovery time naturally is 10,000 years. A tree falling over is much smaller in spatial extent and will recover in a year or so. But in between are all these other issues: aquifer depletion, heavy metal deposition, and there's mercury in the coal smoke from the power plants, floods, forest fires, oil spills. We just had one in the Bay Area last year. Acid rain. They take relative amounts of time to recover by natural causes, and they cover different spatial extents and therefore affect more people. So that's one way to think about how do we, where do we put our energies? On the ones that are covering the most area and have the biggest impact, take the longest to heal. We should be assessing, these are the things that are in the headlines today, and not just in the scientific journals, but in the newspapers. Nanomaterials, nanoparticles are going to not only make us better tennis rackets, but better sunblocks and better microchemical devices to get into our blood cells and find the cancer cells and kill them one by one, and on and on and on. These things are in the headlines all the time, but what about the possible negatives? Human skin did not evolve, if I can use the word, in the presence of nanoparticles smaller than a molecule. And so it's transparent to it. And these nanoparticles go right through the skin, into the body, into the organs. And yet industry is adopting them wholesale in tonnage now to make industrial products. I showed you some pictures of biotech and some worries about those. Earth Sensitive Engineering's projects are those that are so big in scale you can see them from a satellite, and we're doing lots of those. Renewable energy, is biofuels a net gainer or a net loser? Ken and I have had some arguments about this. Ethanol from corn is clearly a net loser. That's a dumb project, but there may be other ways to get it. Social impacts of all of these radio frequency identification tags and so forth, and electromagnetic radiation, we're becoming a wireless world. EMR is everywhere. Is it okay? Well, maybe it is. It probably is, but perhaps not. This is from Francis Collins' recent book called The Language of God, and it's another chart like time. It's the ethics of what do we do with personal genomics. Time on the vertical axis, like it was on the one about environmental impacts, and ethical concerns on the horizontal. From the admirable, let's do it, like we can cure measles, mumps, rubella, and through immunizations, let's do it now because there's no ethical question. But out here in the end, unacceptable, designer babies, designing our own children with precisely predictable outcomes, that is out in the future, and scientists are talking about doing it. In Francis Collins' view, it's unacceptable, should never do it. Block, stop it. In between is, let's invent soldiers who never have to sleep. Or let's add memory aids so we can download our brains into permanent indelible memory and never forget. It's always recoverable. Let's increase our human lifespan. There are things that are, well, maybe they're okay, but let's be careful. And there's lots and lots of things in between, and that's where, of course, the dialogue comes in. Now, I'm going to give you a quick example, and then I'm going to draw this into the biblical and wrap it up, of a project that I've been working on locally to do just that. The two counties north of the Golden Gate Bridge have only one highway to get north and south. That's Highway 101, and it's a parking lot most of the time. Unless you're a grandparent, you can pick your hours, like midnight to 3 a.m., you can travel fine. So there's an abandoned rail line there. We're trying to get a commuter train running, but the opponents have said, no, let's not. Let's instead try something better than a stupid old train. This is a picture of a Colorado rail car diesel multiple unit designed and built down in Denver. That's the baseline plan. But the opponents say, no, let's bring the BART system over. Or let's use light rail. Or let's use bus rapid transit, where you pave over the tracks and run buses on it. Or let's use a multimodal unit, which can run on rail or on city streets. Or let's use maglev. Or let's use the personal rapid transit system with elevated guideways. Or let's use a an advanced bus system that can run on streets with magnetic guideways underneath, and the buses will go follow the guideways on the streets. Or let's put in a monorail. Or let's, there's an elevated monorail SkyTrain. What do you do? How do you decide what's good and what's not so good on simple technological issues like that? So I came up with a way to compare those using the four dimensions that I talked about before. The environmental, well, I say economic because I can't use spiritual in this realm. This is in the public media. The social and the aesthetic. And I came up with a whole list of criteria using these four dimensions and tried to put them together. I said, let's make a matrix, and we can weigh them all, the aesthetic, the social, the economic, and the environmental, against the, in this case, the nine alternatives that would, that have been floated. And I made a matrix, and I filled it out. And I said, if it's a high impact, it's I'll give it a 9. If it's a moderate impact, I'll give it a 5. If it has no impact, I'll give it a 0. And I colored them, except for this error right here. I colored them different colors for red is stop, green is go, and yellow is caution. So that's the top half of the table, and that's the bottom half of the table, and I added them all up. And so I ended up, and guess what won? The baseline plan, way ahead of any alternative, and the worst of all was keep on driving. So this is a semi-quantitative way of comparing, trying to bring in the social, the aesthetic, and so forth into an argument that was otherwise intractable.
Is that report's published?
Yeah, it is. It's on the web, in fact. I'll give you the reference. What do we do biblically? And I see I'm running out of time, so let me see if I can put this together. How much time before you get the shepherd's pole and yank me out of here?
You've got 15 minutes.
All right, then I have time to talk about the Bible. All these things can be done in a way that is dealing with social science and economics and environmental and so forth, and not have to bring in the Bible at all. But this conference is about, well, what do we have to say as a group of Christians who claim to have some insight from transcendent sources, a source? Well, look, God actually has put his people on this planet for a purpose. He did it to the Hebrews in the Old Testament, and he's Christians believe that they've inherited that mission. His method is to call people out to do something. And I'm saying, follow me, when Jesus stated that, is a good capture of that point, to be called out. But not just called out to something. He's going to equip us to do it. There is information upon which we can design our approach. And once that's done, we are actually chartered or commissioned to do it. Now, what does that mean? In each one of these cases, he's calling his people to live lives in service to God's purposes on this planet. We have a purpose for being here. Not to consume, but to carry out God's mission. If we are followers of his, that's the calling. And that purpose is to be his agents on this planet for transformation. If you want recovery of the lost paradise, that's the title of my book. But my book, by the way, has a sort of a play on words, because the transhumanists and the extreme technological optimists would say, we're going to do better than that. We're going to create powers Adam never dreamed of having. So that's the beyond paradise idea. But in fact, that's also biblical, you know, because the original creation had a flaw in it. It had in it the ability to sin. And sin we did. And sin corrupted that original creation. But we understand from Scripture that when paradise is regained, if you want, all potential for corruption and evil will be gone. So the final paradise is better than the first one. The first one had the potential for corruption. The final one has no such potential. Evil will have been defeated and removed. So it'll be beyond the original paradise, better than Adam had it. At any rate, so our job in the interim is to be God's agents for moving in that direction. If that's true, then there must be some biblical purposes for doing technology, and I've given you the secular ones that you find in a textbook, but what does the Bible say about it? Well, first, we should do technology because God gave us the ability to do it, and we should use the abilities that God gave us. No reason not to. In fact, the Bible directs us to do it. Why? To fulfill, to carry out these mandates, which I'll get to in a second. To recover powers that Adam lost at the fall, when he was booted out of the garden. He and his friend Eve were booted out and lost some ability, the most grievous of which was close fellowship with God, conversation with God. But also he was safe in there from the environment. There was no pollution and there was no attack from marauders of any kind. On the outside, however, everything became dangerous. So we want to get back to that. Technology can help. And toil and suffering, labor work became arduous. And so can we relieve that burden? Well, sure, that's entirely biblical. But we get down to the bottom two bullets, get a little bit more nervous about it. If we're starting to develop powers through biotechnology, for example, and the intermarriage between information technology, computer science, and biology, we start marrying those two, creating things and powers and species that Adam never dreamed of or never encountered. If we start making particles smaller than the human skin can see, are we, in fact, getting into worrisome areas? And can we, as technophiles would have us say, can we create the kingdom of God right here on this planet? You know, technophilia is the Greek for techno and in love. You know, love technology. So a technophile is in love with technology. How far can we go with this? What are the mandates? I said there are some. A mandate is a non-explicit command. Some of these are quasi-explicit. A command is do this or don't do that. But a mandate is a derived direction, directed from Scripture. And there are plenty, and they're slightly collective principles. But the first one is to image me. Do what I be like I am. And the image like me is Jesus Christ, and this means progressively transformed to become more like Christ. That is our personal mission, our first mandate. But we were told in Genesis to not just go and have lots of children and not just conquer the earth, but in fact to rule the earth and develop a godly civilization. That's what Genesis 1 and 2 are really teaching, amplified by the rest of Scripture. And you'll find it in the New Testament as well. And in the book, you'll find the resources and the sources for this. We are instructed to, and this is instructions for all of humanity, not just for believers, but some choose to follow it and some don't. We are instructed to live cooperatively, to love one another, to value what's good for all of us. We are clearly told to go and propagate this message. Make disciples of every nation. We are to have a ministry, and that is to bring healing and bring blessing to the creation that God has given. And for this one, I'm sure this will thrill Bob. I go to the Westminster Shorter Catechism to this because it's such a nice summary of the theology. What is our purpose in worship? What's our purpose on this planet? Our chief end is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. All you Presbyterians, stand up. Justice. We are to act justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with God. So some of these are more explicit than others, but I'm saying these are the mandates that we should be pursuing with technology. And we can get more. It's in the New Testament as well. Because Jesus, by his sermons, by his miracles, and by his lifestyle, who he hung out with and what he did, also demonstrated some values that are necessary for us to pursue. And I'm doing this as though I'm building from the bottom up, but in fact, the first several are just sort of equal. He valued family, and let me read a couple of those off. When I say he valued family, I mean he was obedient to his parents. In dying on the cross, he entrusted his mother's care to his disciple, and in his ministry, he used fatherly love for children as a metaphor for God's love for us. When I say he valued human life, he raised people from the dead, and he dreaded his own death. Shelter. He valued shelter because otherwise the parable of the wise and foolish builders would have been pointless. He valued food and clothing. He wanted people to be clothed and fed. Health, because he healed people. Friendship and community, because he had a disciple, a group of friends that he was very close to, and he supported that community. He valued the creation. He valued happiness. He celebrated. He enjoyed life. He certainly valued knowledge and understanding, especially the knowledge from his father. But his highest good, he taught clearly, was God. And if technology interferes with that, placing God at a lower level because we're focused on the good but not the best, we're not following God's directives for our use of technology. Sustainability is a buzzword that's been co-opted and used by the eco-left, but don't be afraid of it. It's also biblical. God owns the creation. God created it and said it's good, and if it's good, it's worth sustaining. But at the same time, he put limits on our use of it, and the point of that is, if there weren't any limits, there would be no sense for sustainability, because God would have said, go do whatever you want. But the two go hand in hand. Intergenerational and interspatial justice is part of the sustainability issue, because if we pollute and put our waste matter in areas, that's always and often winds up near poor people, because the wealthy can send it elsewhere. And e-waste is a big case in point. Our electronic waste with all its heavy metal hazards is going overseas, and people who are impoverished in the underdeveloped or less developed world wind up taking these things apart by hand and dumping toxics in local water. Stewardship. We are told by God to care for his creation. We are told by the Apostle Paul that the whole cosmos is waiting to be redeemed. But maybe with technology we can help with some of that. And renewal is where I start to meddle with your eschatology. The idea that you have heard people say, hey, it's all going to be destroyed anyway in the end, so it doesn't matter. It's almost like, well, I'm being part of God's agenda if I pollute. This is bad theology. In fact, in my reading and my understanding, and I'm subject to, you can leap to your feet if you like, is that the cosmos is going to be purified, restored, made whole, not destroyed. And finally, we're told in Colossians and Hebrews that the sustainer is Jesus himself. That does not mean that therefore we can back off and do nothing. But it means that underneath it all is Jesus, the ultimate sustainer. This is it. I'm at the end now. Technology, if you collect all this, I'm saying there are guidelines for biblical development and biblical use of technology. It will bring praise to the Creator. It will serve God. It will allow us to love our neighbors as ourselves, or make it better, more able to. It will allow us to care for God's creation, certainly not interfere with that. It will promise substantial healing of the effects of the fall from grace, and we'll do it all with humility and without presuming that we can become like God himself. I made a website. I've put up a website in which I'm putting this stuff online slowly, clumsily, but I'm trying to make it a resource for the church. And so the book's already out of date, but it's a start. It's the foundation of my thinking and theology. And no, the book's not out of date. But the problem with technology moves so fast that if I use technology to illustrate the points in the book, next year some new hotter technology will be a better illustration. So that's why it's hard to illustrate a book on technology, because it's good, it has a short lifetime when it's fast as technology proceeds. Therefore, I am done, and I will do what I'm supposed to do next, either sit down or talk.
We do have a few minutes because we're going to have in a small groups discuss and set up.
And I do hope this is the beginning of a discussion. That's my goal, to get it going.
Let's take a few questions and then
we'll... I apologize about what I said. So, yes, ma'am.
Yes, thank you very much, Dr. Saranjan, for presenting this to us this morning. When there are competing claims about the uses of the technology, say the intergenerational spatial notion of justice, and there are two kinds of claims that are advanced as to how technology should intervene in or proceed with those kinds of claims, what criteria would you suggest for looking to technology to try to solve those claims or resolve those claims?
It's magic. Technology assessment, there are actually tools. This is a semi-developed process in the schools of social science. There are things...
In your handout, you have this.
There are things that we already do. But, for example, the risk paradigm. Technical people will tell you, well, we'll calculate the risk. We'll forecast the risk. And we'll take that approach with the lowest risk. But social scientists will say, nonsense, risk assessment is elitist and undemocratic. Because who does the risk assessment? Well, it's technologists. And it leaves out the rest of the society. Why should the technologists be the ones who make all the decisions when technology developers get very little training in social science? Why should they be doing the decision-making for society? So there's that. The Gaussian paradigm, on the other hand, it can be a showstopper. It can bring everything to a halt. If you say, I have to prove it has no possible negative impact before we adopt it, we might not have any technological advance at all. So there's two extremes. Those two paradigms are at war with each other. But then there's an in-between. Let's do trial and error like we already do, but let's realize that we're doing it and do it intelligently and think about consequences. And by the way, there used to be an Office of Technology Assessment in Congress, but Newt Gingrich, remember his contract with America Congress in the early 90s? One of the things they did is they killed the Office of Technology Assessment as a budget-saving measure, but also because it was political. It was saying, let's go slow on technology, let's study it first. It was a resource for Congress when technology raced forward. And they could appeal to this board of technological experts to advise them on what the risks were and what to do about it. The problem was, if you're an extreme technological optimist, you'd say, back off, let technology take us where it will, and let the market decide what's best. Here was OTA saying, well, wait a minute, let's think about the issues, and maybe we'll have to regulate this technology before we allow it to be licensed. This is also political, because the technological optimists, who happen to be Republican, tend to be Republican, and most of the technological pessimists tend to move over to the Greens and the Democrats. You know, you've got things, so it becomes a political issue. But OTA, I think, ought to be brought back. Our public policymakers ought to have a way of assessing technology, and the Office of Science Advisor to the President ought to be elevated and made non-political, rather than subverting science to the political agendas, as I think has been happening lately. But there's other things, and I'm not doing a great job of answering your question. I'm talking at it rather than explicitly answering. But there are techniques. This is one that engineers use and designers use. Design, they're adding additional X's. I mean, design for economics, for design for profit is the most traditional one, and that has to be there or commerce won't happen. But adding compliance with regulations, adding safeguards, adding something where if it's dangerous, it's off unless you turn it on. So if it breaks, it turns off. That's the reason why we were afraid of nuclear isotopes for X-rays, for example, because they're always on. You can't turn them off. Whereas an X-ray machine, you can turn it off by turning the switch. Program termination means things with a programmed life, and Max Smart used to have these. After a certain number of times, certain number of years, it will self-destruct. But we can design things, landmines, by the way, if they shouldn't be banned altogether, they should have finite lives, because otherwise they lie on the ground and kill civilians years after the conflict ends. Sorry, I don't know if I did a good job on your question or not. The question is profound.
Yes, I think it really, really goes in that direction. It might be interesting even to have a varied case study set of individuals solving a particular problem or addressing it through these different kinds of tools, one using the technology forecasting, one using the risk paradigm, to see what different results and they might arrive at and the procedures they might use so to do, and then compare and contrast what those results are.
I would like the church, whatever that is, maybe the denominations, to assemble teams, interdisciplinary teams, to study these issues, including social, spiritual, technical aspects, and come up with guidance for the church. The Catholic Church has been good at doing this, issuing, they had, the last one I remember was the one on nuclear, what did they call it? Nuclear. Well, from time to time on big issues, they'll issue position statements. And they did one on nuclear weapons, and there have been others. Pastoral letters, they were called. Pastoral letters. I think the church, broadly speaking, the Protestant church, needs to start doing pastoral letters on technologies like nanotechnology and biotechnology and others. I think they should. Yes, sir.
But we have problems in the problems we face change. So, for instance, the medical pharmaceutical business, we had thalidomide babies. And so we ramped up the testing, the production, and protection of the people. Then we had the AIDS epidemic, and then people were dying of AIDS. And we said, how can we get the process done faster? And so that it's setting up a rigid structure or too formal a structure has problems because our needs change, because the will of the people actually changes.
Yes, that's right. It's by no means an easy problem, and because it's dynamic, because technology keeps moving, it's going to be ongoing. So we would issue today's wisdom. Here's the wisdom that we have today. But as you've said, some of the issues are urgent because we have done something. We've released the technology into the economy that suddenly we're realizing has horrendous medical consequences, if you will. Something needs to be done very quickly. So we, by all means, should admit emergency response while we're thinking of higher positions to take. What would the Bible, what would God have us do in this matter? What would be out of bounds or off limits? Now, that doesn't mean we can impose that. The church should be serving as the conscience of society and as advisor to government, not doing government, but as advising government on what we think is ethical and moral and what ought to be done. And I think we ought to be doing it. And I think technology is one of the areas that we're failing to deal with as a church.
Let's take one more question, and then we need to get a break.
When you asked for the one-word definition of American society, the word that came to my mind was consumer. And it seems to me like one of the main obstacles to a biblical approach to these issues is a culture where consumption is an idol and where everything is valued primarily in economic terms. Do you see a role for Christians and for the church in trying to undermine or steer that sort of fundamental aspect of the culture that seems to get in the way?
In 1975, approximately, there was a Episcopal bishop who's since died, named Taylor, John Taylor, who wrote a book whose title I forget, but his essence, his key phrase was the theology of enough. And his argument was, we need what's enough. But it's so easily you slip right on past that into overconsumption. Overconsumption, how do you measure that? Well, if it has dissipated impacts on human spirit and psyche, and if it consumes resources of the planet faster than they can be replenished, they can regenerate, if you will. If it's has ethical implications and justice implications in terms of its impacts on people groups. Sometimes I'm afraid when I say these things, people say, oh, that's too big, I can't do that. But in fact, we can get together with groups of people involved, theologians and technologists and social scientists and others from the community who are interested and want to talk about it. We can get together and talk through this thing and come up with guidance. I really believe it's a doable thing. It's broken down into packages of that size. And the example I gave was looking at commuter rail in our area. That's not a spiritual, per se. I didn't add the spiritual, but it's in the back of my mind. I think we should be doing those kinds of things because it's part of repairing the damage and limiting or redirecting technological culture towards a more sustainable one. I think that's godly. I think it's biblical.
Thank you very much, again.